Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name's James Henderson. I'm chairman of the GAS programme, and we're here again to talk about the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war on global energy markets. I'm going to date this podcast immediately. It's the 8th of September in the afternoon, and we've just had the announcement from the UK government about price caps for retail and indeed for industrial and commercial consumers in the UK, and we'll discuss a bit about that later. But first of all, I'd like to get into some other news that's happened since our last podcast, which is around the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. I've got with me today Jack Sharples and Mike Fullwood, as usual. I've also got with me David Robinson from our electricity team to talk about electricity markets later on. But Jack, let me come to you first, if I may. Can you just tell us what's actually happened with Nord Stream 1?
The Nord Stream 1 pipeline, all of the gas that flows through it is pushed down the pipeline from the Portovaya compressor station. And the issue of turbine maintenance at that compressor station has been very well covered since June. As far as Gazprom's concerned, those turbines need regular overhauls every 3 years and on-site maintenance every 1,000 hours. Now, because there was only one turbine left in operation in late August, this occurrence of on-site maintenance led to a complete shutdown on the 31st of August. Now, that was due to last 3 days. Our last podcast was recorded on the afternoon of Friday, the 2nd of September. And later that evening, after the markets had closed, Gazprom announced that an oil leak had been discovered during that maintenance and that the compressor station would be shut indefinitely. Now, since then, Siemens has publicly contradicted Gazprom's claim that such an oil leak requires a complete shutdown, saying that it can actually be repaired as part of on-site routine maintenance. So we appear to have reached a stalemate in recent days. The key question is why the oil leak isn't being repaired. Gazprom claims that such oil leaks were also detected in other turbines and they can only be repaired in a specialised service centre, not on site. But Gazprom refuses to send the turbines away for repair, claiming that sanctions are going to possibly prevent their return to Russia. So, in short, Nord Stream is closed indefinitely.
Okay, so we've lost the flows through that pipe. Can you tell us what the immediate impact of that is on the European gas market?
Well, European prices reacted very swiftly, but actually soon settled down again. So the TTF front month prices were around €210 per megawatt hour before that news. They rose to €245 on the opening of markets the following Monday, but then fell back down again to around €210 per megawatt hour yesterday. And I believe they are slightly higher than that today. But there is also a psychological impact. It's now highly unlikely that Nord Stream will come back online in the foreseeable future, and this affects forecasts for gas supply to Europe in the coming winter, and of course the related market sentiment. Finally, on a practical level, it also impacts the rate of storage injections in Europe as we prepare for that winter.
But in terms of the actual flows that were coming through Nord Stream 1 before that shutdown at the end of August, and therefore which are not flowing now, what were the actual flows at the end of August, which we've lost?
They were around 30 million cubic metres per day, compared to the nameplate capacity of the pipeline, which is about 165 million cubic metres per day. So the loss of those flows isn't quite as dramatic as it would have been if the pipeline was in full operation and then had come to an abrupt halt.
Okay, that's great. Now, so you've mentioned your favourite topic already, so let's get into that, storage. So where were we when the pipeline shut down? And what's happening now with injections and what's the sort of anticipated level of storage as we head towards the 1st of October?
Well, in August, European storage injections averaged around 380 million cubic metres per day. Now, the average for the first 6 days of September is exactly 30 million cubic metres per day lower. So that is the same volume that we lost from the closure of Nord Stream. In terms of where we are in stocks, Europe now has just under 86 BCM in storage, which is around 82.5% of capacity. The question is whether Europe can sustain injections at the present rate, which is equivalent to around 1 BCM every 3 days. If so, then storage stocks by the 1st of October could be 94 BCM. And if, by some stroke of market-based good fortune, Europe is able to sustain that injection rate throughout October as well, we could actually reach full storage capacity by the 1st of November. However, I would curb this optimism here by noting that storage injections do generally slow down as the winter, as the weather gets colder in October, and injections generally cease entirely in the last 10 days of October. So from my perspective, if we were to add another 10 BCM to storage stocks by the 1st of November, I would consider that to be a good achievement. I would add one more point, that the push to build storage stocks has acted as additional demand in Europe and supporting prices. This is not a criticism, given that we will clearly need every cubic meter from storage this coming winter, but it is interesting to note that even in a market with constrained supply, net injections since the 1st of April of around 58.5 BCM are 18 BCM higher than in the summer of 2020 and the summer of 2021, and they are only 1 BCM less than the record which we set in the summer of 2018 in the aftermath from the Beast from the East. So there's clearly a very strong political push to keep those injections going, a strong sort of market push as well from companies preparing for the winter. And that could give us a touch of optimism that the injections will continue for the next several weeks.
Okay, yeah, I was a bit concerned. You were getting a bit over-optimistic there, but then you've curbed us. You've held us back at the last minute there, which is good news. But anyway, nevertheless, it does sound a reasonably positive story on the storage front. And I think, you know, even if we head towards 90 BCM by the time we get to winter, that's a pretty good effort, given where we started the year. But coming back to Russian flows, so we lost Yamal Europe some time ago. We've now lost Nord Stream in its entirety. So just remind us what's left, which pipelines are still flowing Russian gas and at what levels?
So there are actually only two routes left open. The first is the transit via Ukraine, and the second is the flow via the Turkish Stream pipeline. Flows via Ukraine only enter Ukraine at one point across the border from Russia now, Sudzha. For the geographers in the room, that's 25 miles northeast of the Ukrainian city of Sumy. The outward flows from Ukraine into Europe now are mostly at Velike Kapushani on the border with Slovakia, and a residual amount is delivered to Moldova. The flows at Velike Kapushani have remained very consistent since the 31st of May at around 36 million cubic meters per day, which is exactly one third of the volume originally agreed in the Russia-Ukraine gas transit contract. The flows here peaked at 80 million cubic meters per day in March before falling to 60 million cubic meters per day in April and May, and then falling again at the end of that month. So we've seen a stepping down of Russian gas flows via Ukraine. The Turkish stream flows enter the European market on the Turkey-Bulgaria border, and the flows here of just under 40 million cubic meters per day in recent days are very similar to the monthly averages for July and August. Interestingly, this is around 40% higher than the average for the 3 months of April, May and June combined, and actually back to the volumes that we saw in the winter of 21-22 between October and March. So the volumes on these two routes are therefore rather stable, and I would expect them to remain at this level in the coming months. Here I want to emphasise that the flows via Turkish Stream serve only an isolated portion of the European market. It's Hungary, Serbia, Bulgaria before they were cut off, Greece and North Macedonia. So therefore the rest of Europe now only receives gas through a single pipeline route via Ukraine from its border with Russia at Sudzha to Slovakia.
Okay, and I guess just for listeners who think about these things in annual terms rather than daily terms, those flows through Turkstream and Ukraine would be equivalent, if I'm right, to around 28 billion cubic metres a year, and that would be compared with the 2021 level into the EU of 155. So that kind of gives some kind of context. That's about right, yeah?
That's about right, yes. So the flow data that I have for 2021 shows actually something slightly lower than the European Commission estimate at around 142 BCM. If the flows continue at their present rate for the rest of the year, then that figure for 2022 will be 65 BCM. So that's a 54% year-on-year decline. And if we get down to 28 BCM next year, if the flows essentially remain flat for the next 12 months and beyond, then that's another 54% year-on-year decline next year. So quite a significant curtailment of supply, let's say.
Okay, I mean, that's quite a big assumption as well, I think, isn't it? That we kind of even maintain where we are. So what do you think are the prospects for flows through Ukraine? What's the risk of losing that as well?
Here, I would say that it remains a distinct possibility. Although Sumy is outside the sort of active combat zone at the moment, now that the Ukrainian army have regained territory there, I would say that nothing can be ruled out. So just to give an example, on the 26th of July, the Ukrainian TSO warned that Gazprom had unilaterally increased the pressure in the pipeline at Sudzha, which could have had dire consequences. So, for example, an explosion there because of excess pressure in the pipe would potentially take months to repair. I think that given that we've already seen the loss of Russian flows into Ukraine at the other pipeline interconnection point at Sokhranivka, and obviously plenty of highly politicized discussion around Nord Stream, I don't think we can rule anything out.
And what about Turkstream? Do you think that's a bit more secure because of the countries that it kind of supplies gas to?
Yeah, absolutely. I would certainly say that this route is more secure, given that Hungary sits at the end of the line and obviously has recently signed a new gas deal with Gazprom, and indeed has requested that all of its deliveries are made via Turkish Stream. It's also notable that because they supply Serbia, Serbia is considered somewhat more friendly towards Russia than most other countries in Europe. So at least from a geopolitical perspective, I would say that the Russian government would probably be more reluctant to countenance a cutoff on this route. And finally, obviously, it's very difficult to cut off that route without cutting off supplies to Turkey as well, which is something I don't think they want to do at the moment.
OK, well, look, thanks, Jack. That's a really interesting and detailed look at the flows. Mike, let me come to you now, if I may. I mean, in our last podcast, you discussed your work on the kind of exposure of certain regions, and you particularly picked out Germany and Central and Eastern Europe. And of course, with Nord Stream 1 now being empty, they're very much reliant on Norwegian gas and LNG imports. So could you give us a little update on, you know, where we are with Norway, but mainly what's going on with LNG import capacity?
Yes, thank you, Jim. Yes, I mean, there's been obviously a lot of discussion and a lot of activity in terms of bringing basically FSRUs, floating storage regas units, into Netherlands and especially Germany. That seems to be proceeding apace. So the Eemshaven point in the Netherlands, they could well be receiving cargoes very soon to effectively start in the fourth quarter in terms of sending regasified LNG into the system. The Germany ones, we might get one or two in the first quarter, but the build-up is going to be through the year. So there's talk about there's five FSRUs in Germany, which are sponsored by the government, one private one, and they'll probably be all on stream by the end of the year. I mean, in total, if we take the current Belgium and Netherlands capacity, which is at Zeebrugge and Gate, which actually they're running at about 15-16% over capacity in terms of LNG coming in and sending out, then adding the Eemshaven one and the six Germany ones, next year we'll probably double the capacity into that sort of Northwest Europe region. In a full year, it probably increase it a little bit more once they're all sort of up and running. So, but that's the capacity. Obviously, it relies on LNG supply being available to come into those terminals, which is by no means a certain thing.
So what kind of volumes would you, I mean, I know it's a slight guesstimate, but what kind of volumes would you hope that could come into those terminals in 2023?
Yeah, I mean, well, the current capacity in 2022 is, let's say, 24 billion cubic metres, and that's probably going to double next year. So an increase of 24 BCM, but it's probably, if we get two-thirds of that, we'll be doing probably pretty well. And also, some of that will divert LNG away from other areas, including parts of Europe. And one of the diversions may well be away from the UK, which means the UK can then only export less down the interconnectors. So even if we got, say, 15, 16 billion cubic metres extra LNG, the net addition may be somewhat less than that, but there should be some net addition.
Okay, so if we take the 15, I mean, and compare that with what we've lost through Nord Stream 1, which is, on an annualised basis, 55, I mean, we're still way down, aren't we? So it's
oh yeah, we're well in a hole, yeah.
Yeah, it's helpful, but it's not the ultimate solution. Okay, so those are the volumes, and obviously there's desperate attempts to find alternative sources of gas supply. But what about the other EU response, which we should talk about? There's been talk of price caps both at a wholesale and a retail level from the EU and also from various countries. Could you just talk us through some of the things that have been discussed?
Yes, well, there's a big EU meeting tomorrow, I think, to discuss these. And we've seen a series of what they call non-papers kind of leaked out. I think they're probably just testing the water on some of these things. Some of these things, you know, somebody said there's no such thing as a bad idea, but I think I've seen one now. So in a number of these. I mean, there are no real price caps in this price cap sense in the EU at the moment, because they need to get full agreement amongst themselves to do that, because it goes beyond their sort of remit. The response so far has largely been actually handing out cash to people. The French government did cap the electricity price using EDF because it's state-owned, and I think David Robinson is going to talk about what's happening in Spain and Portugal. In terms of the price caps, there's been a lot of talk of the special concern about TTF being obviously at a very high price. Is that a proper price for the European market, given it's a lot higher than some of the neighbouring hubs? There's been talk about, you know, maybe having a different price to TTF as a European price, you know, JKM plus a euro. And there's obviously also been talk about capping the price of gas coming from Russia. That was the one thing that did come out of the speech by Ursula von der Leyen yesterday. So that proposal would be discussed at the ministers' meeting tomorrow. That was picked up by Vladimir Putin at a conference he had in Vladivostok. He said it was a stupid idea. And if that happened, then Russia would just cut the gas off. So I think the prospects of that getting through the ministers is probably fairly slim. It's difficult to see Hungary agreeing to it. It's difficult to see Germany agreeing to it either. I mean, it seems to be, again, cutting off your nose to spite your face. If you cap the price, the volumes drop to zero, prices everywhere else go up. So it'd be interesting to see what comes out of that. But I think they're struggling, really, with trying to cap prices, certainly the wholesale level. They're making up with something on the retail price level, which obviously is a lot easier to cap rather than wholesale prices.
And of course, if they start capping retail prices, they need to fund that somehow. And there's been some talk of kind of windfall profit taxes to kind of fund any gap between wholesale and retail prices, which is kind of interesting. But we should move on and talk a bit about an example, not in the EU, but in Europe, of the UK, which today, as I said before, announced a kind of huge package of support for consumers. Can you talk us through what they've suggested and what you think the cost of it might be?
Yes, Jim. I mean, Ofgem had announced a few weeks ago a rise in the price cap for the typical household, which is often reported as £3,549, which is a big jump from the £1,970 in the summer period. And the announcement this morning was that the government will effectively step in and limit the price cap to £2,500. So that's a reduction of about £1,049. Part of that reduction is coming from removing the green levy. That's approximately about £130 of that. But the rest is effectively capping the wholesale gas and wholesale electricity price at obviously a much lower level. As far as the wholesale gas price is concerned, then in the £3,549 price cap, the wholesale gas price was around about £3 at that element. And with the £2,500 price cap, it's around about £2. So there's been a reduction of £1 a therm, and a similar sort of reduction in percentage terms on the electricity element. So the £1,050 reduction, there's roughly maybe 25 million households it sort of covers, would imply about £25 million. However, Ofgem used this typical household definition, which is a medium-sized three- or four-bedroomed house, and actually overall average gas electricity consumption for households is a bit less than that. So the cost may be, let's say, of the order of £20 million. Also, support for businesses announced, which it seems to say that the price going into the wholesale price cap will also be applied to businesses. Businesses consume overall quite a bit less than households. That's both commercial and industrial, excluding the power generation sector here. So maybe the cost would be of the order of sort of £30 billion plus for that. And that's over a whole year. The problem is, if you look at the current forward curve for gas prices, which will obviously translate towards electricity as well, the forward curve for 2023, which should be the next calculation, is £5 a therm. So if the government are going to limit that to £2 a therm, they're effectively tripling the subsidy from £1 a therm to £3 a therm if prices stay there. So rather than maybe £30 billion, you're talking about £90 billion next year. And there seems little prospect, both on the forward curve and any sort of forecasts, of getting back down below £2 a therm until about 2026. So this is, I take the view, it has to be a temporary measure. It's inconceivable that the government could go on funding this level over that longer period of time. So this is kind of a holding measure, I think, awaiting what might become a more permanent solution.
Okay, so that's the UK outcome. And of course, the UK government have been very strong on the fact that they're not going to impose windfall taxes to try and fund it either. So this is all onto the UK balance sheet and the taxpayer ultimately. But coming back to the kind of the theme of gas markets, I mean, so retail and industrial consumers are going to get protected to an extent in the UK. But how do you see the outlook for the winter gas market in Europe as a whole, given these kind of the conversations we've had about LNG imports, but also the conversations around, you know, EU politics?
Yeah, it's pretty horrible, really. I think obviously with Nord Stream 1 shutting, then we're down at the bare minimum, as Jack said, of Ukraine and Turk Stream flows into southern Europe. I think with storage doing reasonably well, despite Jack's little bit of pessimism, then actually with a mild winter, I think you can probably just about, if we have Russia flows from Ukraine, Turk Stream, may just about squeak through, but only by sort of emptying storage. The real problem, I think, comes in refilling storage in 2023, because the Russia flows won't be high enough. So a little bit of kicking the can down the street. And while we may struggle through this winter, although if Ukraine gets switched off, which I guess is Putin's next card to play, then you certainly won't get through this winter. But come winter 23-24, it seems unlikely, whatever the EU says about filling to 90%, there's not enough molecules in the world for the EU to fill to 90% if Russia flows remain at current levels or even lower. The 23-24 winter could look catastrophic compared to this winter.
Okay, it's tough to see some light at the end of the tunnel then. All right, Mike, well, thanks a lot for that analysis. So, David, let me turn to you then. We've talked a little bit about price caps already, but the impact of gas prices. But can you talk us through, from a European perspective, what the impact of gas prices has been on electricity markets?
Well, the simple story is that electricity prices have risen in tandem with gas prices, and from an average of about 30 euros to 50 euros per megawatt hour in early 2021. Day-ahead prices are now well over 300 euros per megawatt hour and have reached levels in excess of 1,000 euros per megawatt hour in some countries. It's not just that they're high, it's that they're high consistently. So we're not talking about spikes. We're talking about long periods of very high prices, which are unprecedented. The reason for this is simple. Wholesale electricity prices are priced to clear, which means that there's a single price paid to all the generators that are generating in the market. And that price is the offer price of the marginal generator required to meet demand. And that's frequently a gas-fired plant. So as long as natural gas prices are high, wholesale electricity prices will be too. And now, this is not initially a problem for consumers because they usually have fixed prices or tariffs that don't change for many months or even for years. However, if the high gas prices last a long time, then the high wholesale prices eventually feed through to retail prices, which is what's happening right now. And, you know, this has led to, as we've just heard in the UK, to not only serious economic hardships, but also serious political difficulties. And the prospect of continued high gas and electricity prices in Europe is what explains, you know, the reason for the, it explains the meeting tomorrow, which the European energy ministers are having in order to discuss and presumably try to agree on how to bring those electricity prices down.
Okay, and before we get to that meeting, I mean, there's already been some interventions by some European countries. I mean, you live in Spain, and Spain and Portugal have introduced a measure to break the link between gas prices and electricity prices. Could you just explain to us how that works?
First of all, there are fundamentally two measures being discussed in Brussels. One is to do with capping gas prices, which Mike has already discussed, and the other has to do with capping electricity prices. But the Iberian exemption, as it's called, for Spain and Portugal essentially tries to do a bit of both. It's got, here's in summary, it does the following thing. It defines a gas price limit, say 40 euros per megawatt hour, although increasing. And it defines the electricity market price, wholesale market price, in terms of that limit. So electricity, wholesale electricity prices are much lower than they would be if the gas price was actually what is the international gas price. So this enables, if you want, prices for consumers to be lower. However, the beneficiaries of this in Spain are only those consumers who previously were buying in the wholesale market. There were over 10 million small consumers who were. This was one of the reasons why Spain moved so quickly to try to cap prices. But the other side is that of this sort of story is that the gas generators, the companies that are generating with gas, of course, have much higher gas costs, so they have to be compensated. Now, in this model, the compensation does not come from the government. It comes from those consumers who benefited from the lower gas price. So they essentially have to, take part of the savings, so to speak, and give it back to those gas producers who were generating, at a much higher price than the market price. There's a further twist on this, which is that the European Commission required Spain to offer the same low wholesale price for its sales into France. So France has turned from being an exporter into Spain into a major importer from Spain and benefited in a big way from these lower wholesale prices. The biggest criticism of this model is that it has lowered the gas price and the electricity price to levels that actually encourage demand for gas and to increase production from gas-fired plant. There are debates about whether this is a fair criticism, but it is the one that the European Commission has used to, reject this as a model that might be applied elsewhere.
Okay, well, on that point then, I guess we've got the meeting tomorrow of the European Commission and its member states. So if they're not liking the Spain and Portugal model, what are they discussing as a means of market intervention to decouple gas prices and electricity prices?
This proposal, which is the Commission's proposal, is also very close to the German proposal. So I think it has a kind of a higher probability of leading the debate, if not, deciding the outcome. It has three main elements. The first would allow wholesale gas market prices to define the electricity wholesale price. However, it would cap the price of inframarginal generation at an agreed level, which has been reported to be 200 euros per megawatt hour. So these inframarginal generators, which could be renewable generators or nuclear generators, would be selling at a lower price than now, since they now are receiving the full wholesale market price. This would obviously lower the inframarginal plant's rents, and the difference is considered by the system to be a saving or a revenue, which can then subsidize lower prices to consumers. The second measure that the Commission has proposed is to promote demand response among consumers. And you can see this to compensate the incentive to increase demand resulting from lower prices. The financing, the extra money, so to speak, that is freed up by paying inframarginal generators less will be used to incentivize demand flexibility, demand reduction, particularly of electricity at peak, when gas is expected to be running. The third measure is to support the most vulnerable customers. I mean, there's a within each member state, but also there is a solidarity component where state countries with significantly more revenue, so to speak, can subsidize countries which are not in a position to help their vulnerable consumers. These are all very complex elements, but as I say, I think if I haven't already said so, that we're talking about the beginning of a negotiation. There are many other proposals on the table, many details, and again, the devil will be in the details.
Okay, and just a sort of final question then. looking at the longer term, these are obviously emergency measures to respond to the current crisis. But how do you think they might affect investment decisions and the prospects for the energy transition going forward? Is this going to be a negative, or is it going to be a positive to encourage greater investment in renewables?
Well, I think there's a serious risk here that investors will lose confidence and be more reluctant to invest, thereby slowing the energy transition. You know, it will depend on many different things, but and there are ways to avoid this. But the first is to insist that with the inframarginal generators losing revenue as a result, they have reason to be concerned about, you know, whether or not, well, first of all, they'll be concerned about that, but they will also be concerned about what whether future investments will face similar sorts of risks. As I say, I think there's two particular measures which can be taken. One, which is now being proposed in the UK, and that is to reach agreement with the owners of these inframarginal plants whose revenues are being cut. In the UK, renewable operators who have renewable obligation certificates sell their electricity into the market and potentially can earn very high profits. The government has proposed that these generators transfer their rights to these rocks and to that treatment and adopt instead what are called the CFDs, contracts for differences, two-way contracts for differences, which apply to many of the other renewables on the system. Under this system, when the market price is above the strike price in the contract for difference, then the generator gives the money back to the government and to consumers. If the prices are below that strike price, then the company is paid some additional funds. Now, this agreement would imply that the companies which are now earning significant profits in selling into the market would give up that opportunity, but would receive a long-term contract at a fixed price, the question being at what price and whether in the longer term consumers would be paying more because of the higher price that was being paid for a longer period on these contracts for differences. So that's one way. The second way is if you want to gain consumer confidence, is to be clear about how long these emergency measures will last and what the post-emergency market design will be. They would be well advised to ask whether in future the existing market system, which sets prices on the basis of marginal resource, will actually be a problem, because currently the marginal resource is natural gas, which leads to very high market prices. But in future, the marginal resource will be renewable energy, which has marginal costs close to zero. This could easily see wholesale prices reaching levels which are non-investable. So I think it's very important here to insist on understanding and defining what the market will look like after the emergency is over, in order to give investors confidence to invest further in renewables and in the flexibility resources that are needed to integrate them.
Okay, well, thanks, David, so much for that. I mean, a complicated issue, obviously, and one where we can see that, you know, responses to the short-term problem could have a significant impact on the long-term as well. And, of course, that's going to be critical in terms of the energy transition. So thanks very much to you, David, for your contribution. To Mike and Jack as well, thanks to you. I'm sure we'll be back to discuss all these issues as the winter moves on. But in the meantime, please do continue to look for our research on our website and look out for future podcasts. We'll be back in a week or so with another one. But in the meantime, thank you very much indeed for listening. Stay healthy and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.